Ladies and gentlemen, it is December the 22nd, 1:37 p.m. on the west coast of these United States of America. My name is Arthur. This is the Apologia Center Thursday interviews, where we bring on guests and we have really fun conversations. We have a number of firsts for today's guest. I really hope that you are as excited as I am. So I'm going to bring him on. And then we're going to talk about those firsts, what those firsts are, because I want him on camera when we're talking about these things. And then we're going to just have a very fun, lively discussion. So, Joel Schmidt, what's up, brother? How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, my dude?
We are doing well. We'll see if Liverpool wins this game. So, doesn't look like it, but who knows? Anything can happen. Still got 15 minutes of game time. So here are the firsts. I think you're the first guy, first and foremost, that has just recently finished his bachelor's degree. But you're published. You have a book out already. You got another one coming out this upcoming year. You're 22 years old. And you got a bunch of articles that you've written. You're the first who is probably maybe as passionate as I am about the sport of soccer. Now, you got a big smile on your face because Arsenal's sitting at the top of the league. And nobody really expected that, I must say. You are the first who is actually not a Christian who's on my channel. So you're an agnostic, and we've had plenty of philosophers and theologians, but all of them have been Christian believers. So thanks again, because this is going to be cool in regards to that. We actually have a legitimate issue to disagree on. Maybe we might find a lot of stuff that we actually do agree on. We've already started that I'm a Liverpool fan and you're an Arsenal fan. So how did
that's the irreconcilable aspect. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We might be able to agree on God, right? I'm unapologetic over the fact that I want everyone to become a Christian. So who knows? You might end up being a Christian, but you probably won't become a Liverpool fan.
That's almost certain. That's almost certain. Yeah.
That's okay. I'll take that, man. I'll take it any day. But so tell us, man, we have people on, Joe, and they share their kind of journeys. Usually they're folks who finished their PhDs or done graduate school. You're 22, my guy. And, how did you make that work? Like, when did you graduate high school? 13? Like, tell us about this. Like, how'd you do this?
Yeah. So I'll tell you where I am now and then basically how I got here. So where I am now in May, I graduated from Purdue University. I got my bachelor's. I majored in philosophy, which is the queen of all disciplines, of course. And I minored. Yeah, exactly. And I minored in biology. So that's pretty fun. Adds a little spice in there. Currently I'm in my gap year. So I just finished applying to a bunch of different grad schools for philosophy. So fingers crossed, I should be hearing about that in March or April, around then. And then, yeah, off for the fall 2023 semester, starting with grad school. So very excited for that. That's where I am currently in life. I'm having fun writing books and articles and making YouTube videos on my channel, Majesty of Reason, and things like that. So that's me currently. As for how did I get here? Well, I grew up in a Catholic home, and I grew up a devout Catholic, and I was very, very privileged to go to Catholic private education, K-8, as well as high school, and that, you know, we had theology classes every day, essentially, and that's kind of bordering on philosophy of religion, So sort of been always thinking about topics like God, apologetics, these sorts of transcendent matters, as it were. And so that's kind of always been in the background. And yeah, so I grew up going K-8, going to mass, going to church, praying, all these sorts of things. And then around seventh or eighth grade, and because Catholics are thankfully very open to science and things like that, you know, the harmony between faith and reason and things like that. They were happy to teach evolution at our school. And so I found that to be so fascinating. When we were in seventh and eighth grade, I started learning about evolution. We watched the Ken Ham, Bill Nye debate in class, because that's around the time when I was in seventh and eighth grade.
How old were you when that debate happened?
Either 13 or 14.
Oh, my Lord. Okay. I'm 37, by the way. So I'm just trying to play stuff here. It's like when you're like...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so we watched that in seventh or eighth grade. I forget which one it was. And then we talked about it as a class, and we had to write like an essay on it. It was so, so awesome. And we were learning about evolution. I just thought it was so beautiful how, like, from such humble origins, we got this, you know, proliferation of diversity. I thought that that was just beautiful. And then in ninth grade, as I reflected further, though, on the evolutionary process, my awe towards it began to diminish and began to wane, just because I started... As I put it in the preface of my forthcoming book, actually now it's out, the Existential Inertia and Classical Theistic Proofs book, as I put it, the suffering involved in the evolutionary process pierced my mind and heart. And so that's in about ninth grade. So this is freshman year. And so then that, I really started to grapple with that because, you know, there's like pain and death and suffering before what I took to be the fall. And also there is just, you know, this is the very means by which God is bringing about his beloved creation. It's like death and suffering and predation and parasitism. And it was just difficult for me to reconcile that with my belief in a provident, all loving, all good, all knowing God. And so that didn't immediately, you know, that didn't like destroy anything. It just kind of, you know, started pulling on the threads. And so then I started investigating these matters further. I started watching debates between theists and atheists online, you know, like William Lane Craig stuff and like Jeff Lauder, who ran the Internet Infidels and Secular Outpost, and getting into the work of philosophers as well. So like Paul Draper, and, you know, he really influenced me a lot. He was actually at Purdue, and so I got to study under him, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, around, so it was a long process, but maybe in 10th grade-ish, I in some sense, you know, deconverted, and I considered myself like a metaphysical naturalist. I thought that the natural world is all that there is, and yeah, that just exhausted reality. And then I guess in 11th and 12th grade, so this is like sophomore year and junior year, junior year and senior year, I think it was the summer in between them, I came across this YouTube channel called Worldview Design. And it is by Dr. Joshua Rasmussen. A lot of your audience will probably know Josh Rasmussen. And I just binge watched his videos. And I was like, well, this guy is all up my alley. He's all in favor of the intellectual virtues. He does it with love and care and caution and rigor. I started reading his articles and things like that. I reached out to him and we had email exchanges back and forth, like hundreds of emails. Oh, it was so awesome. And I ended up getting his book that he wrote with Alexander Proust called Necessary Existence, and they argue for, you know, this necessary foundation to reality. I also read a lot of other of Proust's books, so I started getting into more theistic philosophy, and these guys took me out of metaphysical naturalism and kind of put me into a state of agnosticism. And then that kind of persisted throughout college, you know, refining my views here and there on different topics, but generally the sort of agnostic stance persisted and is still persisting until right now. So that's kind of my trajectory. It's a long and, you know, I'm prescinding from various details, but that's the short of it.
Cool. So would you qualify yourself as, so you don't believe in naturalism. You don't believe in physicalism, correct? Would that be fair?
Yeah. So right now, I mean, I'm sort of, it depends on how you define naturalism. Because some people allow you to have a kind of non-physicalist naturalism, okay, so long as the physical is fundamental. So you can have like non-fundamental, non-physical things. Like maybe mental states are not physical, but they're just like not fundamental denizens of reality. They're not at the rock bottom. So I guess I'd say that I'm agnostic between naturalism so construed and theism. But as for like straight up physicalism, you know, whether or not there are like non-physical mental states, for instance, I actually lean towards, yeah, something like a broadly non-physicalist view there.
And then how would you classify your agnosticism towards God? Would this be like a strong agnosticism, meaning, for those who don't know, that it's impossible to have this kind of knowledge, even if God were to exist? Kind of a softer or weaker agnosticism where, hey, I'm really open to the evidence. I'm looking at the evidence. If I'm convinced by the evidence, then I change my mind.
So as you rightly point out, there are a bunch of different agnostics, and there are even further categorizations like within
Correct.
those, and then orthogonal categorizations. So you can get into the distinction between like beliefs and credences, and well, do they have to have a certain credence range, et cetera. So it's very difficult. But yes, as you just characterize it, I would fall under that weak agnosticism category. And as I explain it to people, I basically say, no, I don't claim that it's impossible to know one way or the other. What I mean is this, that by my lights and by the evidence and experiences that I've come across, the evidence and my total range of reasons is roughly, very roughly counterbalanced between theism and, let's say, naturalism or some suitable atheistic hypothesis.
Very nice. Here's one thing that stood out to me. Other than when I saw videos, I was like, who is this young kid that a bunch of guys I know are talking to and interviewing? Is that you are very gracious with the conversations that you have, specifically with Christians that I've seen. By that, I mean that you look at arguments. I think you're very fair with arguments. You don't kind of look past them like, oh, just nonsense. It's crazy people who want to believe in a sky daddy or something like that, right? Like these typical kind of online conversations we get to see in the comment section, you go and believe in the sky daddy and have fun. You look at the arguments. What kind of what draw pushes that? What is the thing that makes you like that? Let me put it that way. Right? Is it your upbringing? Is it like, hey, I just know really smart people who I respect, who believe this stuff. Like what drives you there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's mainly two things. I mean, one thing is my upbringing. I mean, I've had a really good education, and I'm very grateful for that. And it's instilled within me like a love for truth, and like taking that kind of center stage. And so that's kind of been shaping my whole trajectory. It's like I've been trying, at least I've been trying to get at truths as much as I can and to avoid falsehoods as best as I can. And it's like I try to see that as my fundamental guide. Now, of course, right, as humans, we all succumb to various biases. Like we know this from the psychological literature, et cetera. But there are various things you could do to at least try to mitigate the effect of those on you. So, I at least try to mitigate the effect of those and try to pursue the truth. And part of that comes from my upbringing. Part of that comes from just really great teachers that I've had who've inspired me to have a love for learning and for truth. Part of it is just I've tried to absorb this fundamental philosophical attitude where, come what may, it's like it's the truth that matters. Socrates essentially is a martyr for truth.
Correct.
People even put him to death, and they're like, you can't go around corrupting the youth in this way. You can't, undermine democracy by questioning the leaders' conceptions of justice and things like that. And he's like, listen, I mean, sure, put me to death. The unexamined life is not worth living. Like, you're giving me these two options. It's either, I could be free and not talk about these matters and not philosophize and not seek the truth, which is a kind of death unto itself,
Yeah.
or you could just put me to death. And he chose the latter. He's like, just put me to death because that unexamined life is not itself worth living. And so I've tried to cultivate that philosophical attitude. And again, like I recognize that I'm not perfect in this. I constantly fail, et cetera, but at least I can try and try my hardest. So yeah.
Very nice. The reason why I asked that is because I think sometimes when people deal with these sorts of conversations, they think we're these computing devices. It's like you're gonna input a bunch of data, and then it's gonna spit out a belief, right? Like there it goes. I'm an atheist, or I'm a theist, or I'm a Christian, or whatever like that. Without realizing that we're motivated for good reason. I actually think it's part of being human. I mean, those are good reasons. We have motivations that go beyond that. Right,
Yeah.
and we have motivations that might make it easier for us in living our lives. For me, for example, I would say like objective morality is a huge thing. I think grounding that in God is a very important thing, and without it, my life would look very, very different than the way it looks. Is it the only reason I believe in God? No, I think I have other reasons for believing in God, but that's a good one, I think. So I'm gonna sort of maybe put you on the spot. I'm not sure. And then we'll do the opposite of this as well. Which one of the arguments do you think for God's existence is the best one? Or best one according to you, right? Like the one you like and you think is pretty good.
Yeah. Probably a version of the contingency argument is probably one of my favorites. So yeah, I'd probably say a version of the contingency argument. So, you know, for the audience, there's a distinction between contingent things and necessary things. So contingent things exist, but they didn't have to exist. They didn't have to be in reality. It's not necessarily the case that they're in reality. They could have failed to exist. So like this water bottle, I've got this water bottle here. Presumably, this thing isn't a necessary being. It didn't have to be in reality. Someone might not have ever made it. I could destroy it, etc. So it doesn't have to be in reality. Lots of things around us are like that. Moreover, at least in general, when we look at these sorts of contingent things, things that could have failed to exist, they have explanations. They have explanations outside of themselves. So something made this, right? And something made you and me, namely the various, our parents, as well as various environmental factors that went into our constitution and so on. So in general, we see that things that can fail to exist have explanations. Not only individual things, but also collections thereof. So like the collection of apples, right? Apples as a collection have an explanation outside of themselves, namely in terms of certain selection pressures on ancestral organisms of apples, etc. So both individual and individual contingent things and collections of contingent things, at least in general, we witness them having explanations. And you might think, in addition to this widespread inductive support that we have for it, experiential support that we have for it, it's also intuitive, you might think. Like, if something or a collection of things genuinely could have failed to be in reality, there's a kind of puzzlement. There's a kind of mystery as to why they are, in fact, in reality. It's precisely because they could have failed to exist that you're like, well, then why do they exist? If they could have failed to exist, then why do they exist? It seems intuitive that they need some sort of explanation, or at least that they have some explanation outside of them that accounts for why they exist. And if that's the case, if we have these twin testimonies of reason and experience testifying to this principle that contingent things, whether individuals or collections, have explanations outside of themselves, well, then just focus on the collection of all the contingent things that there are. Per this principle, that's going to have an explanation outside of itself. And no contingent thing, of course, could be the explanation of that. That's part of the very thing that we're seeking an explanation for. And hence, there's going to have to be some necessary ultimate foundation for contingency. That's the basic thought. So there we get to this at least one necessary foundation of reality. Now, proponents of the argument, I think, are sometimes a little bit too swift in identifying that necessary foundation with God. But, you know, at least it takes us a step closer, right? that's kind of the idea, because God would be a necessary thing. And we're at least ruling out views on which either there is no fundamental reality or fundamental reality is contingent. So it at least in some sense takes you a step closer to God. And then there are various different stage two moves. Like, so that's the first stage of reasoning that gets you to a necessary foundation of reality. And then stage two tries to, you know, tease out divine attributes from that. So there are various other attempted maneuvers in stage two that I'm ultimately, as you can imagine, not fully convinced of, but, you know, they're at least probative and interesting. So I'd say that's probably my favorite slash one that I find most plausible.
Yeah. Stage two being like, what sort of a thing would this necessary thing be?
Yeah, thing like, or things, because we want to leave it open whether or not it's one. Yeah.
Correct. And then breaking that down, right? Like, would it have to be intelligent? Would it have to, you know, have a will? Things of that sort. And then you work yourself backwards, you could say, depending on your starting point. I'll say backwards. Now, what do you think is the best argument for, let's say, atheism / agnosticism? I don't know if agnosticism necessarily, like, because you're looking at it, you're saying, well, I see him go both ways and I'm, you know, in that middle ground. And so therefore I'm going to withhold judgment on the subject. So
it's probably one similar to the one that I was sketching when I was detailing my story, my sort of deconversion story. And then it's interesting, right? The two that I just gave when I was detailing my deconversion, then quote unquote reconversion, but deconversion, I've had two deconversions, one deconversion from Christianity to naturalism, and then I deconverted from naturalism to become an agnostic, right? So I just detailed an argument that sort of got me to deconvert from metaphysical naturalism in some sense. It's more complicated than that. But now I'm going to talk about the other argument that originally made me deconvert. And I actually think it's one of the best, just by my lights. Different people have, different sets of experiences and resources at their disposal. So different arguments going to strike differently for different people. And that's perfectly fine. So for me, yeah, it's going to be something like an argument from evolutionary animal suffering. So, I mean, we just know empirically that there have been hundreds of millions of years of, and I mean, I'm talking hundreds of millions of years of animals. These are non-human animals, right? Ripping each other to shreds, predation, parasitism, languishing, suffering, death. There have been, five mass extinctions. And we just know that the history of life on Earth is in large part of just a huge bloodbath of death and suffering and violence and things like that. And at least antecedently, by my lights, it's extremely, extremely surprising that this would be like the creative means by which a perfectly good God would bring about biological diversity in general and humans in particular. After all, God could have brought it about by could have brought about biological diversity in humans in ways that didn't involve such massive amounts of suffering to non-human creatures. So by my lights, it's just super duper surprising that the very means, the very core of God's creative process involves, is just fraught with such atrocities. It's just so surprising by my lights. And by contrast, if the sort of, if whatever is responsible for the evolution of sentient creatures is indifferent to their flourishing and languishing, it's much less surprising. Because fundamental reality just doesn't give a crap about how the evolutionary process goes and whether or not it involves animals ripping each other to shreds, which is unfortunate. But so to me, it's just extremely surprising, this piece of data on theism. And it's not as surprising on let's say, naturalism. And, a lot of the standard tools that theists use in responding to the problem of evil are just unavailable for this, because these are non-human animals. It's not like the pig or, the dinosaur is like, I'm going to grow in my character and exert my free will. They're not like exerting their free will. They're not growing in character. They're not like growing in their relationship with God because of this. These are like non-moral agents. So they don't really have these moral qualities of character growth and free will and so on. So it's like a lot of the standard maneuvers to get around this sort of argument are just, or to get around arguments from evil in general, setting aside whether or not they work on their own merits, they're largely, I'm not going to say wholly, but they're largely going to be, by my lights, impotent with respect to this particular problem. So again, there's much more that can be said both for and against, both the arguments that I've articulated here, but these are two that pull on my mind particularly strongly.
It's a good one. I think a lot of people might not be used to hearing an argument of this sort. I'd say a lot of Christians would not be used to hearing an argument of this sort. Because there's typical ones, and then there's ones kind of that are outliers. Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me about this specific argument, at least I have two questions that come to my mind, and they're just personal ones for you. By the way, let's promote your YouTube channel before I ask the next question, because I want people to interact with you. I want Christians to interact with people like you, rather than, I won't name any names. Go ahead.
Oh, that's funny. I thought you were going to give some examples, and I was like, I could give many examples as well, but let's not name any names. So yeah, people can check out my, thank you for doing this. People can check out my YouTube channel. It's called Majesty of Reason. It comes from a quote from Baruch Spinoza. He is an early modern rationalist philosopher. It's such a beautiful quote. The quote goes, "What altar of refuge can a man find for himself when he commits treason against the majesty of reason?" So it's like, you've got no altar of refuge if you're committing treason against the majesty of reason. It's like, you have to respect, it's a respect for reason, whatever reason ends up being, right? I mean, if I am respecting something that I construe as under the guise of reason and ultimately it is God, that's amazing, right? That means all my worship to Tash, as it were, is accruing to God, as C.S. Lewis put it in, I think, what was it, The Last Battle or something like that. So I just see it as a kind of ideal that's majestic. And maybe that ideal is, I'm seeing as under a different guise, and ultimately it's God. If so, that's awesome. So that's my channel.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's my channel. I host discussions with other philosophers. I put out lecture videos of my own. Sometimes they get up to 12 hours long. That one, I've had a lot of people who have really, really been just benefited from that on both sides of the aisle. The 12-hour long one on arguments for God's existence. I go through a lot of these topics in philosophy, religion, metaphysics, and I really think that, you know, people who are getting stuff out of the conversation that you and I are now having, they're definitely going to get stuff out of my channel.
True that. You know, I remember reading William Rawls' God. William Rawls has a book on essentially their arguments for God's existence. And I took a philosophy of religion class when I was doing my graduate work. And I'm reading this book, and I had no idea the guy was an atheist.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that was so refreshing. Like, I'm reading this book and stuff like that, and I don't know, I got into a conversation with my professor and stuff, and then he said, you know, that guy's an atheist. And I was like, no. I was like, man, that's so cool to see him actually present the arguments in such a fair way. And then I read another book of his where he gives his reasons for God's existence and for atheism, not lack of God's existence. And essentially had to do with the problem of evil. It was a version of the problem of evil and stuff. I really struggled with it. It was a really good struggle. But again, it's one of those things is when we can deal with people who are being honest with the info. I don't care on what side they're on. It's extremely refreshing. Here's the question I had for you when you brought up the animal suffering stuff. Now, I get the kind of kick in the guts when we think about all sorts of suffering. But it comes from a place other than of like, that just doesn't feel good. Right? Like, it seems to me that there needs to be some kind of an objective morality thrown into here. It's like, it's objectively a bad thing for animals to suffer. So I have two questions related to this. First one, it's that, like, answer the morality questions. And one person, at least in the comment section, has asked this as to what your justification for objective morality and stuff like that is. The other one is whether you're a vegetarian or not.
Yeah, so I mean, I can take the second one first. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not currently one, but I have wrestled with their arguments. I find some of them more plausible than others. I ultimately haven't been convinced by a lot of them because I do think that there are morally relevant differences between humans and non-human animals that can justify differential treatment, etc. But you know, that would take like multiple ethics courses to explain, so that I don't really have the space to do that here. But yeah, anyway, that's what I'll say on that. So I'm not currently one. I'm definitely open to becoming one. And I have engaged with some of their arguments. I'm not yet convinced. That's what I'll say here. The second thing, going back to your first question. So the first thing that I want to say is, I'll answer your question directly, but the first thing that I want to say is that strictly speaking, answering this question is not needed to run this argument because we can just take the data as suffering and then, or as animal suffering in the evolutionary process, and then we can ask how expected that is under the two given hypotheses. So maybe under the naturalistic hypothesis, we could even suppose that it's not, let's say, and I disagree with this, but we could even suppose that it's not objectively bad for them to suffer and so on. Still, it's not going to be as surprising as under the theistic hypothesis, where it is objectively bad for them to suffer and so on. Correct. And so you still get this differential amount of surprise and differential degree of expectation of the data, right? So it's still going to be very unexpected on theism, so I would argue, and it's still going to be nowhere near as unexpected on the naturalistic hypothesis. And so, given that we just characterize our data as this extended process of animal suffering, questions about the objective morality sort of fall to the wayside, at least insofar as we're examining this argument and its evidential impact, just because we're not characterizing the data in morally laden terms, and the hypotheses still differentially predict it to different degrees. So, and then that's all that you need to run the argument. Okay, so that's the first thing that I want to say, is just that this question is, strictly speaking, orthogonal to the argument.
Okay, but secondly, to rephrase this, sorry, before you go on, to rephrase for some people that might have tuned out for a second, you're essentially saying that what you need is to show that evolution, animal suffering, and the goodness of God is internally, amongst at least the theist or Christian, is internally inconsistent.
Or there's a tension there. You don't have to say inconsistent. You could just say tension.
You're being very generous now.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, so that's a, yeah, that's another way to put it. That's a good way to put it. The second thing that I would say, which is just directly, so yeah, the first one is that strictly speaking, an answer to that question is orthogonal to the force of the argument. But now I can answer your question directly. So I mean, we could disentangle two questions here. One of them is the justificatory question. So like, why would I or anyone believe that morality is objective and that their suffering is objectively bad, versus the metaphysical question of like, what are the metaphysical facts in virtue of which, like the objective facts out there in virtue of which their suffering is bad. So those are two different questions. I mean, on the first question, moral epistemology, across the spectrum, both theists and atheists alike in metaethics, largely agree when they're realists, they largely agree that our primary justification for this is going to be what philosophers call intuitions or seemings. So you just reflect on cases of suffering or cases of virtue or cases of vice, and it just really strongly seems to be the case that they are bad or objectively bad, or that they are objectively good, things like that. This isn't any different, that so these philosophers say, from, for instance, you reflecting on the one and the plus function and the equality function, and just seeing automatically that 1 + 1 = 2. I can't give you some proof or derivation of that. I can't, show you any scientific facts that prove that. Still, I know it's the case because it's just so obvious. It just seems so clearly true. We use our intuition in that case. Similarly, so these philosophers argue our primary way to know what is whether there is objective morality, and as well as whether a certain act is objectively good or bad, is by using this moral intuition. You reflect on the cases, and it just strikes you as obvious. It just seems to be the case that it's objectively good or objectively bad. Without the justificatory force of intuitions, you're pretty soon cast into radical skepticism. We need to use intuitions to justify mathematics, to justify logic, to justify these sorts of things. If you throw those out, then you don't have math, you don't have logic, and then thereby you don't have science. You just, our whole epistemological edifice collapses. So I guess that's the answer to the justificatory question. But then there's a question of the metaphysics of the matter. So I think that there are a number of different accounts that one could give. One is, for instance, just an Aristotelian account. You could say that it's, the badness of suffering is grounded in the fact that this is a way for a creature to languish, and the languishing and flourishing conditions are set by the intrinsic natures of creatures and things like that. So like, we can examine the nature of a plant. And when we do that, we can see that there are certain conditions under which plants flourish. They need a certain amount of water and sunlight and soil and things like that. And we can also examine conditions under which they languish. And similarly, we could do that for sentient creatures. And we can talk about the conditions under which they flourish and languish, and that's set and undergirded by and grounded by certain facts about their essence or their nature. And so instead of grounding it in some sort of transcendent being like God or something like that, we look inside the beings. We look at their natures and the conditions under which they flourish and languish as set by their natures, given what they are, what it is to be a sentient creature. And then that can provide a foundation for these objective claims about their sentient states, etc. So that's one Aristotelian approach that you could take. There are other various approaches that you could take to grounding this sort of thing. I mean, you could, for instance, I mean, we could go through all of them, but like one of them is just to say that it's grounded in, I'm trying to f figure out one that isn't too difficult to explain. Like I could go into Kantianism, I could go into contractualism, I could go into like all these different theories
Sure.
that don't require God's existence, but that nevertheless can offer an explanation for the objective badness of
Yeah,
what
that's
these
fine. We
creatures
don't
are
have to. I mean,
undergoing.
we're not trying to
Yeah.
give a class on ethics here.
Yeah. Okay, so that I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, if you're interested in taking a class on ethics, then when Joel's professor, you can take that class. Or you can just check out
Exactly.
his YouTube channel at one of those 12-hour videos.
Exactly.
I'm sure he can. It's interesting to me because of, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm maybe not connecting dots where I should be. You said, well, I'm not really convinced of the vegetarian kind of stuff. And I got this justification as to why I would eat meat or something like that. My thought was, why wouldn't God have a similar kind of reasoning as to the allowance of the suffering of animals? Or do you think it's just too much or something like that?
Yeah, so there are a few issues here. One of them is like we might wonder whether or not it's allowing versus doing. Because, like, in God's creative act, he's not necessarily. So it sort of depends on the metaphysics of creation in this
So, okay,
case.
so
But
got it.
you might think that God's not allowing the suffering. But, like, this is something that he's superintending. Like, this is his creative means, right? Like, he's choosing to actualize biological diversity in general and humans in particular through this evolutionary process where
Correct.
he could have providentially orchestrated things in such a way as to, for instance, make it a young Earth creationist universe so that
Yeah,
you can
so we're
entirely
not
switch
talking
back then.
post, we're not talking post-fall, let's say, if we're using Christian lingo here. What you're saying is that, hey, to get us to that whole creation and the way it established, if he's using evolution, then he is actually actively, theistic evolutionists would argue for this, right? That he's actively guiding the evolutionary process as opposed to the language I used when it comes to allowing things to happen. Got it. I
So
think that's fair.
that's one point to make. Another point to make would be that yes, w would be to say, okay, sure, in principle, God could have a morally sufficient reason that justifies him in, let's just say, superintending this process. So in principle, yes, God could definitely have a morally sufficient reason. And what that shows us is that it's not strictly inconsistent to suppose that God exists plus this extended process of suffering exists. But there's still the more fundamental question is it something that we would expect, right? So like imagine let's just step back and suppose that we went to an alien planet and they're basically just these torture chambers and there are creatures in there and they are just being tortured for every single waking moment of their lives. And we have certain hypotheses about whoever set this up. And one of them is that it's a perfectly good, perfectly in control, could have, achieved means differently, et cetera. And then the other one is that it's either indifferent or a malicious thing. The people who are defending their hypothesis that it's a perfectly good superintender of this planet could say, oh, well, maybe there's a morally sufficient reason that the creator has. And listen, I grant that, but like we have to ask, is this really what we would expect still? Like there could be in principle a morally sufficient reason, but it just still seems really, really surprising that this is what the what we would what would what this being would manifest. And so similarly, if we translate to the case at hand, someone might say that, like, yes, in principle there could be a morally sufficient reason. I grant that. So there's no inconsistency here. It's not like this refutes theism. But there's still a sense in which this is not what we would expect from a perfect being. So I guess that's a second point. And then a third and final point, and there are other points to make, but this is a third and final point that I'll make here, is that you might think, well, there might also be, really strong moral reasons of which we are unaware for God not to permit the suffering that we see and not to actualize it this way. And so given that there are these two reasons, like there might be strong reasons that God has to allow this, sure, but there might also be strong reasons that override that for God not to allow this. And so given that we're in the state of kind of ignorance about these higher order reasons, they kind of just cancel one another out. And so we're just left with the reasons of which we are aware, and those do strongly tell against God's allowing it because it's so suffering filled. So that's so like the unknown reasons kind of count seem to epistemically cancel out one another when we're trying to assess whether or not theism sort of makes this likely or predicts it. So I guess those are my three responses.
I got, but this is great, by the way. I'm enjoying this. I'm learning
Yeah, and let
because
me
I'm
just
trying to
say
reason
that,
through this argument. Yeah.
yeah, I mean, let me just say that again, it's possible to go back and forth on these matters. Like none of these points that I'm making are settled in the literature. There are responses to these, and then there are counter responses to those responses. So like
Correct.
the dialectic goes on, and what I want to do here is I just want to give the audience like a taste of some reasons that some people might have for let's say agnosticism or something like that. And they're not supposed to be decisive. They're not supposed to settle the matter. They're not supposed to shut off debate. It's not like there aren't any possible responses to these. I just want to emphasize that, just to recognize the sort of limitations on
Correct.
arguments in general.
And that's why you're an agnostic and not an atheist.
One reason, yes, one reason.
Like because if people oh, slam dunk argument, that's it, it's over. Mic drop. We're done with this. I mean, as you're saying it, I'm just again thinking on my feet and saying, well, here's a possible response I would have to this. Like let's just say we're having this conversation, I'm trying to convert you, right? Let's just say. I'm like, okay, what about this? What about this point? What about that point? Or if I'm like, hey, Joel's got a really good argument, how can I get out of this myself? It's like, well, I would go about it this way, given my current worldview. I know there's, in the comment section, there's a number of comments being made about the morality and stuff like that and all that. And you're saying intuitions are brute facts. They're just the way it is. And intuitions are, you know, guiding us with our morality. It's just the way it is. That's the sort of stuff we are. And I don't necessarily need a justification for this. If I'm misrepresenting you, please just tell me I am.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'd say, I mean, I don't think I gave anything brute. So again, we have to distinguish like the epistemic side and the metaphysical side. Mm-hmm. So on the metaphysical side, I gave a grounding. So there wasn't anything brute on the metaphysical side. As for the epistemic side, yeah, there's a sense in which, okay, we have the intuition. Is there anything further that I can say to justify the intuition? No, I guess not. And so in that sense, it's a brute intuition. I guess you could say that. But I mean, like, the theist is in the same boat. Like, why does the theist think that something is wrong? Like that, you know, the person next door who stole, let's say, a cat, why is that wrong? Well, because it seems like just like it's obviously wrong. And I mean, I guess they could say, oh, well, because, you know, God said that it's wrong, or, you know, other sort of things. But like,
oh, yeah, we're made in the image of God, and therefore we're moral or something like that.
Yeah, and but then you could just ask of those further things. Well, how do you know that? Like, why would you believe that? And then eventually they're going to get to something where it's like, oh, well, it seems that God exists, or, you know, it just seems to them strongly that God exists. Or if they reason to God's existence on the basis of other premises, then you could just ask about those premises. Why do you believe those premises? Ultimately, you're going to have to say, because they just seem obvious. You know, like, it just seems to be the case that these premises are true. I mean, if you don't do that, and you just have to further give argument upon argument upon argument, you're going to have infinitely many premises justifying your original belief. Like, for this premise, you're going to have three premises here. Oh, why do you believe those premises? Oh, you have to start giving three more premises for those, et cetera. If you can't bottom out in something like just this kind of brute intuition in favor of something, then you're ultimately never going to have any justified beliefs. You have to give argument upon argument, and it's going to be infinitely many premises. None of us reason like that. And so we all have to bottom out. Even the theist, in justifying their moral claims, they have to bottom out ultimately in something like the kind of brute intuition that I've been appealing to. So there's nothing intrinsically suspect about that. We're all in the same boat here. We're all in the same epistemic boat.
Cool. Somebody asked a question, and I want to combine what I've written down here and then the question they asked, see what you would say on that. So she said, how much suffering is too much suffering? The question I'd written down is, if the numbers of animals are lowered, would that in any way affect kind of your view on this?
Yeah, so as for your question, and then I'll answer the questioner's question. As for yours, I mean, I think, you know, as you start, you know, really significantly decreasing the number of animals that have been suffering, I think, yeah, the force of the argument does decrease. I mean, I still think it'll be, you know, reasonably powerful, but it will decrease because it's just like, it's not as much of the problematic data, right? So that kind of makes sense. So I think I'm perfectly happy with, you know, granting that. As for the questioner's question, how much suffering is too much? I guess the question, you know, like, we could precisify this question. Too much for what? Too much to be inconsistent with God's existence? Well, I mean, as I was kind of articulating earlier, I'm not really interested in whether or not something, you know, this is strictly inconsistent with God's existence. Again, like, for all I know, maybe there's some strange morally sufficient reason that God has. The same thing could be said with the torture chambers and the overseers on that planet. I guess the question is, when we're generating expectations, it's like, how much is too much? Well, then the question is, how much is too much for it to be not super duper surprising on theism? And I guess the question, to answer that question, we'd probably just have to look at how much suffering seems like it's not really needed to bring about, like, the goods that God is seeking to actualize in his creative act, like biological diversity in general and humans in particular. And it does indeed seem like a lot of it goes over that threshold, because, you know, after all, God could have, for instance, made a young Earth creationist universe where he completely circumvented all that suffering and yet still secured his creative ends of bringing about humans. Correct. And biological diversity. So how much is too much? Well, I'd say however much is not needed in order to bring about these goods that God is seeking to actualize. Then it's just going to be, in that sense, gratuitous. It's going to be needless. So I'd say however much is too much is just however much of that is gratuitous, or at least seemingly gratuitous. Again, we can't say with absolute certainty, but at least we can use relative plausibility here. It's a good question, I should say. Like, both of those questions are excellent questions.
Thank you. it's so much of this. You're like on the spotlight, and I don't mean it to be. It's just interesting to bounce this off of you, because typically, I'll say this to whether the people watching are Christians or not, or atheists and stuff like that. Typically, we get into these conversations with friends and family members, or coffee shops and stuff, and after a while, it turns into shouting match and. Really unnecessary, and it's not fun anymore, yeah. Right? Like, you're not really gleaning anything, you're not learning anything. So it's always refreshing to sit down across someone and be like, man, like, just respond to this, because I'm not you, I'm not in your shoes, I don't have the beliefs that you have, and I can guess at what your answer would be, but I don't really know what your answer would be. So that's why I'm throwing these questions your way. So much of it rests on evolution being true. Or at least our current model of evolution being true. I'm not just asking this in the sense of, like, what if it's false, right? Like, it's like, so what? What if it's not, right? But I remember about a year ago or so, maybe a bit longer than that, there was, man, actually conversation with, like, four different folks sitting there. I think the Hoover Institute did the conversation. But, one of the guys was one of the leading mathematicians or programmers or something like that who had just come out and said, hey, I just think our current model of evolution is just false. Like, the data does not add up. Like, I suppose if you came to some kind of a reason like that, this whole thing would change in your mind. How sure are you? And that may be an unfair question. If it is, just say, hey, that's not cool. How sure are you that evolution is true?
Yeah, how sure am I? So this is one of the things that, you know, I did, like, when I was younger, because I was, like, addicted to evolution as I sort of, you know, like, 7th and 8th grade, I bought, like, all the books on it that I could. And I actually got a few over here, I think. Got Origins by Rolnick, The Selfish Gene by Dawkins, The Vital Question by Nick Lane. The Greatest Show on Earth by Dawkins, other sorts of things, certain biology textbooks. Okay, anyway, I'm just looking over my bio.
You know what I was doing in 7th grade? Watching Dragon Ball Z. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe you did that too. But that's the difference, right? For some people sitting there saying, 7th grade, man, I remember I was a knucklehead in 7th grade, and you were reading biology textbooks and trying to figure evolution out. But hey.
Yeah, so anyway, that's all just to say that, you know, I did, like, a huge deep dive into this, and, you know, I do think it's very, 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 very well empirically confirmed. You know, we can't be certain about any empirical hypothesis. I'm certainly not certain in it. I'd just say, you know, I don't have any precise numbers, but I'd just say very confident, and am going along with the very large scientific consensus on the matter. There are a few dissenting voices every here and there, but they're largely on the very far outskirts of the scientific community and et cetera. And broadly speaking, we have to distinguish between, like, the precise theoretical characterization that we currently have of evolution versus just an evolutionary process. Okay, we're much less certain. I'm definitely confident in this. We are much less certain in the precise theoretical characterization of evolution than we are that something like evolution occurred. Like, it is very, very plausible that something like an extended process wherein you have more simple organisms and generally you get more and more complex over billions of years. We are very, very highly confident in that. We have so many fossils, we have so many radiometric dating methods, we have so many. But where we're a lot less confident in is the precise mechanisms by which this operates. There are, you know, there are certain mathematical challenges to certain precise models here. There are certain, like, different selective pressures that might not have been available for other certain models. You know, like, there's debates about punctuated equilibrium versus gradualism and other sorts of things. So, like, the precise method and means by which this all worked, some aspects of that, yes, are definitely, like, up for debate. But what the scientific community doesn't question almost at all is, like, that there was a process that took billions of years and that went from simple to complex and which involved, like, predation and things like that. And that is all I need for my argument. And we are far, far, far more confident in that than any, like, precise theoretical characterization of evolution, which are currently on offer and which are, like, debated among, the relevant scholars. So, I mean, that's an important distinction.
So if I were in the debate with you, okay, then and debates are funny sort of things, right? because there's tactics in debates, and you can win it just based on being like tactically well-rounded, and not necessarily the truths of your
or even
your
being arguments. Like likable.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, you're friendly. The audience likes you, and all that stuff. Yeah. For what they are, I mean, they're good for certain purposes. I prefer conversations of this sort. I think they're a lot better. But if we were just be going back and forth, let's just say we had a moderator here. The way I would formulate this, I would actually argue myself into an agnostic position on animal suffering, but I would argue backwards, right? Kind of the way you were saying, like, we know that evolution happened, right? Or some kind of a process of things happened, and then we don't know the details. I'd start something, let's just say, like, I'd give a number of arguments for God's existence. If I didn't want to go, like, full on Christian theism, I'd say, well, we've established that God exists. And then there's these questions where I don't have the answers to, so I'm going to remain agnostic on it. But trusting in the goodness of God, I'm just going to kind of punt it to he must have had a good reason for doing what he's doing. Because, you know, like, and with Christian theism, I could go, let's just say, give arguments for the resurrection, and then say, well, this is true, that is true, we're good here, so God exists, I believe all that stuff. Joel's got this really good argument that I'm having a hard time with. I'm going to be agnostic on the answer. You've come across something like that?
Yeah, so that's okay. That's an entirely respectable move. In general, in philosophy, whenever you have an argument, right, it's basically a conjunction of premises, and that conjunction entails a conclusion, right? What you could just do is, you know, the person who's mounting the argument says, hey, I want to affirm all these premises, and thereby, because it's, you know, deductively valid, we get the conclusion. But other people can come along and just say, well, you know, I reject that conclusion, so at least one of your premises is wrong. Sometimes it's, you know, it's helpful to point out which one it is, but, you know, you don't often have to. If you just have really good reason to think that the conclusion is false, you can infer just that whole conjunction is not true. Maybe, you know, this one's false, maybe this one is false, maybe you don't know, but you can always do that. And that can always be done really for any argument. And so, I mean, it's a limitation on arguments, and it shows how when you assess an argument, it has to be sensitive to your total range of reasons, your total range of evidence, your total, like, this is why it's so difficult to inquire into these matters. It's like you have to be constantly doing this global assessment of your range of reasons, all your arguments, and all your evidence, and so on. So for me, I mean, this argument would be a chip that counts in favor of the naturalist side, and then I'd have to weigh that up against all the others. But for other people, you know, they could just say, well, okay, but, you know, they could just take the approach that you took because they have a different, they occupy, as I put it, a different position on a grand epistemic landscape, the space of reasons and experiences that people can have. So, yeah, I mean, that's just a general limit of any argument more generally, whether theistic or atheistic. So, like, consider on the other side, someone could do basically the same thing. They can say, well, yeah, Joe, this is a really plausible argument, so you've taken me to naturalism or atheism, and then when I come up against, you know, certain theistic arguments, maybe I don't really know how to respond to them, you know, but I have good reason to reject their conclusion, and so I just sort of remain agnostic on where their premises go wrong, but I know they go wrong somewhere. So, like, notice that basically... an atheist could do like the same thing to the theistic arguments. And I think that that's ultimately fine. Again, this is we have to weigh the total balance of our evidence and our reasons. And it's a difficult matter. It's a person-specific matter. And this is why philosophy is so difficult and why you get so much disagreement, ultimately. Just because
just to defend philosophy, because you're a philosopher, I'm a philosopher. And I'd like to think I am. But... because there's a caricature of philosophy and philosophers particularly that we just talk nonsense all day. We never come to conclusions, and it's a complete and utter waste of time. And I mean this on a grand scale, just like the populace, right? So when I told my dad I'm going to go study philosophy, he was like, what's the point? Like, right? Why would anyone do something random like that? Like go become a doctor or a lawyer or something like that, right? Like something useful. And then also it's in the academic sphere as well. Like, so even popular names like Richard Dawkins talks about like philosophy being sort of useless and stuff like that. And, and you kind of look at it and you go, oh, come on, man, that's really unfair. That's not cool, right? Don't do that. And we're saying these things and you're saying, well, the argument can go this way. And I'm saying the argument can go this way. And somebody might be watching and saying, there they are, these philosophers not coming to any conclusions. And that's why you need these very fundamentalist, on either side, by the way, like views, like, no, it's complete nonsense, belief in God, or there isn't any truth other than what the Bible says, some form of, you know, stuff that we've probably come across. How do we defend philosophy that it's a worthwhile endeavor and it is difficult, but you can still come to truth? Everything doesn't resolve and kind of boil into, well, Joe gave a decent argument, Arthur gave a decent argument, and then we're just going to say, well, both are decent, let's go both our ways or something like that. Like, truth is actually what we're pursuing. You and I both are in pursuit of truth. Now, we've concluded currently in different places, but that's our pursuit, and we think there are things we can for sure say, hey, I know this.
Yeah. So, as for how I defend philosophy against those people, it's sort of simple, it's sort of not, but it's like, hey, they are doing philosophy in the act of criticizing philosophy. That is the basic response.
Correct.
In order to mount those criticisms, they have to get, you know, they have to give premises, they have to show that, you know, the premises deductively entail the conclusion. That's already partly doing philosophy, because you're constructing premises, you're trying to justify the premises, you're showing that they lead to a conclusion. You have to use the canons of formal logic to show that it's valid, etc. So, I mean, they're doing philosophy in order to try to show that philosophy is useless, which is a kind of funny self-refutation of sorts. It's like a performative self-contradiction. Like, in order to say that, you know, only the Bible is true, etc., like, you can ask, how do you know that? How do you know these sorts of things? And then they start appealing to reasons, or maybe they just, it's completely arbitrary, but then, you know, we're just going to ignore them because then they just have arbitrary, unjustified views. So, like, yeah, in order to criticize philosophy, in order to have any good criticism of philosophy, you have to do philosophy. You have to mount an argument. You have to justify the premises. You have to appeal to reasoning. You have to appeal to experience. You have to appeal to various sorts of things. And then you are doing philosophy. So, as I see it, you either do philosophy poorly or you do it well. There's really, you can't get away from doing philosophy. Even implicitly, you know, people absorb from the culture and from social media and from TikTok and these other sorts of things. They absorb views. They absorb metaphysical views about whether or not God exists. They absorb ethical views about whether moral realism is true or moral relativism is true. They absorb applied ethics views about whether abortion is moral, immoral. You cannot get away from these philosophical questions. I mean, I guess you could try to be like a Peronian skeptic, but I don't think anyone wants to do that. Where you just completely suspend judgment on absolutely everything, including whether or not you exist, including whether or not the toilet's over there and you can go to the bathroom. It's just not livable, right? So if you're going to live in the world, you have to do philosophy, including if you want to criticize philosophy, you have to do it. Okay, so that's the basic defense of philosophy. Is there truth in the matter? Well, I mean, if someone wants to try to say that there isn't, again, they're doing philosophy and they're trying to arrive at the truth. So, I mean, by their own lights, they have to admit that there are at least some truths in these domains. So, I mean, that's another sort of performative self-contradiction if they want to try to argue that there isn't. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, again, we just try to do our best. Sure, there's a lot of disagreement. But, you know, as long as we map out the correct range of views, like theism or atheism, one of the two is true because they're exhaustive. So at least some people have, in fact, reached the truth of the matter, right? So that's another point. It's like whenever philosophers are such that they defend each of a range of inconsistent views that totally exhaust logical space, you know at least someone's gotten to the truth. And so at least some people can get to the truth of the matter. And then, you know, the question is, how do we try to figure that out? Again, we just try our best. We try to look at the arguments. We try to reason through them. We try to develop the best worldviews on offer. It's difficult, but, you know, ultimately it's unavoidable. And the only other way to live is to ignore it or just not to live. To live as a Peronian skeptic. So,
that's not a way to live.
Exactly.
You're going to have kids and doubt whether they exist or not. But
exactly.
Your wife would probably won't be very happy. Justify cheating. It's like, well, I didn't think you existed. It would be very strange to live an existence like that. Look, we're coming to the end of it, and it's been phenomenal. I think we'll probably have future conversations as well, because I've thoroughly enjoyed this. And I'm sure so have other, there's been a bunch of comments and stuff like that. The reason, by the way, guys, I haven't asked your questions, is because I didn't want to take the conversation in that direction. Very clearly telling you exactly the reason is. It's not because I'm avoiding it. It's not because I don't think it has answers or something like that. It's just I think if I asked specifically some of the questions that were put there, it was going to guide us in a different direction. And I didn't want to do that. I like the flow of the conversation and the direction we were going into. So it's YouTube. There's a bunch of people that come in and watch these things, and some of them tend to be younger, and they're, you know, developing their ideas and thinking through it. And then again, on all sides, I try to do this within the Christian space. Okay, actually listen to people's arguments. Read the best atheists out there. Read the best from the other side. Right? Don't close yourself off and don't be scared and just do it. But one of the things that bugs me personally is when I continuously see folks from the other side just saying false things about Christians and Christians being stupid and just really not being honest with the history of thought, like the great thinkers that Christians have produced in the world, who are reasonable individuals. I mean, you know, it's so unique that you said, hey, I was reading Josh's stuff. I was reading Josh Rasmussen's stuff. And that dude's a Christian, right? Like, you weren't afraid, like, oh, man, he might convert me or something like that. So I want you to give some advice to folks. Particularly, maybe you can start on the agnostic atheist side and then end with the Christian side on how to navigate through all these stuff. And because life is continuously a learning endeavor and we change our minds and we come across new arguments and those things and even experiences that are going to guide us into certain directions.
Good, good question. Well, there are a number of things I could say. One of them is, I guess, don't be afraid. One of them is just don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to listen to views that you disagree with. Don't be afraid to read books that you disagree with. Don't be afraid. That's the thing. Don't be afraid of the truth. Just try to pursue it as best as you can and just try to commit to, like, I mean, listen, wherever it leads me, even if it's comfortable, even if I like it, even if I don't like it, even if it's uncomfortable, right? Sometimes reality is uncomfortable, but we still have to believe it. Like, I may not want to believe that let's say I broke my leg. I don't want to, like, believe that I've broken a leg. I don't want a broken leg. I don't want the world to be that way. But, you know, ultimately I conform my beliefs to the truth of the matter. And so just try not to be afraid. That's one big thing. Another thing is, yeah, try not to surround yourself in that kind of echo chamber where disagreeing voices are diminished, are marginalized, are deemed irrational, are deemed not worth listening to, and where you don't hear the best cases from that other side. So that's really what an echo chamber is. It's not a good epistemic environment because you're shutting yourself off to lots of potential truths, as well as, even if they don't have truths, they might have good criticisms of arguments for truths that you might think are good, but that are ultimately not good, even though the conclusions might be true. So try not to situate yourself in an echo chamber. This is for both theists and atheists, right? So if you listen to theistic YouTube videos, it's perfectly fine to have, like, a majority of the videos that you listen to be theist. Again, like, no one is saying that you need to, like, only listen to the other side. So it's perfectly fine to have a majority, but, you know, just try not to have it be the exclusive sole guide to your intellectual inquiry that you're only listening to people from your pre-existent side. Try to at least listen to the best representatives from, if you're an atheist, from the other side, from theists and theistic YouTube channels and theistic books. If you're, and similarly for the theist side, right? Listen to the best atheistic and agnostic YouTube channels and things like that. And books as well. Books are really good. I highly recommend reading like philosophy books in these sorts of areas. So I guess those are two main things. One is don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of the truth. The second one is, yeah, try not to have an echo chamber environment. And then a third one is, you know, this can just be a guide. Like, whenever you're, you know, trying to navigate these sorts of conversations, just try to keep in mind a spirit of curiosity and love, right? Those two sorts of guides, and a love for truth as well. Mm-hmm. But, like, if you're curious going into a conversation and you're loving, you're not necessarily going into the conversation with the sole aim of, like, showing that the other person is stupid or showing that they're wrong or, you know, convincing them and showing that your side is the right one. Try to go into conversations, at least in large part, to learn and be curious and also to love your dialectical partner and opponent. It's difficult, but, you know, it reaps its rewards, it reaps its benefits, and you will start to see treasures of reality that you may not have otherwise seen. So I guess those are three or so recommendations. One book that I think both theists and atheists could enjoy, and it should be accessible for the most part, and it'll give you both sides of the topic of God's existence. It's a debate book between Josh Rasmussen and Felipe Leon. It's very good. I advise both Christians and atheists. You will hear, if you're an atheist, you will hear your side represented, and you'll hear criticisms and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And if you're a theist, you will also hear your side. If you're a Christian, you'll hear your side defended, and you'll go back and forth and back and forth. So it's kind of like, it's not like a one-sided attack on your beliefs. So that's a good way to sort of get into this space. And it is called, Is There a God? A dialogue, or something like that. Is God the best explanation of things? A dialogue. It's published with Palgrave Macmillan, I think in maybe 2018 or 2019, I think 2019, by Joshua Rasmussen and Felipe Leon. Highly recommend everyone to check that out, and that's a really good intro.
Very good. I think you've given me enough, and I've met Josh. We actually, a number of years ago, we were in a Christian school in the philosophy department, and then we ended up having lunch together and stuff like that. But you've reminded me that I need to reach out to him and probably have him on this podcast and talk to him about it.
You should tell him that I sent him to you.
Yeah, I will. Like Joe gets credit for this.
Yes,
but
and tell him
for those who don't know about Josh, he's one of the best up and coming Christian. I don't want to say up and coming because he's like coming. he's up there. But as a younger thinker, because a lot of Christians are probably aware of J.P. Moreland, William McCraig, like these older dudes. Joshua Rasmussen is a serious thinker, guys. And he's really good at what he does. So, Joe, I want to thank you, man. I want to thank you for taking... I think that was a good note to end on, right? Like, we want to encourage folks to continue their inquiry and thinking and searching after truth. Now, I think at the end of the day, both you and I can agree that believe the truth, accept the truth, no matter where it leads you. That's just the reality of the, like, your life will be better for it if you do that, right? So I don't know. Maybe the next time we talk to each other, Liverpool will be lifting the trophy.
I doubt that.
I doubt it this season. It's so bad.
Good luck making the top four, but okay.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what they do in January, and they need some serious purchases. That midfield is hollow.
Yeah. Yeah.
But hey, look, given all the options, if it's going to be Chelsea or City or United or Spurs, I'd take Arsenal to win the league.
Yeah, so, I've heard a lot of people say that to me. I really don't want City to win it, to be honest. Like, I will honestly take like Chelsea above them. I wouldn't take Tottenham above them, but I'd take Chelsea above them, and Man U above them, and Liverpool above them. I mean, honestly, I hate them so much now. But okay,
well,
you don't need to go into it.
Consider how I feel losing to them by 1 point.
Yeah,
multiples. That is just ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous.
Yeah, maybe we can have a watch party or something like that, and with our jerseys on. I like you got your scarf up there. It's nice, man.
Yeah, yeah, dude. Arsenal sent me a free scarf. So back in August, I ordered my Ødegaard jersey. It's like really their nice third kit. It's like black, and it shipped like a week late than I expected. And you know, 4 months later, Arsenal sent me a free scarf, and it's not even that one. It's another one that's upstairs. I know they sent me a free scarf, so it was awesome. It's pretty cool.
Hey, that's good customer service. Well done.
Yeah,
well done, you Gunners.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Joe. I really appreciate it, man. Everybody
yeah, thank
else,
you for this.
Thank you for watching. I hope that you go and check out Joe's blog, check out his website, check out his channel, interact with the man's stuff. I think we're going to see a lot better and greater things from him. He is a young man. I can say that, which is really weird. But he is a young man who thinks clearly and thinks well through these subjects. So I want to thank you guys for, again, joining us for this. I will not have a live Q&A maybe tomorrow because my kids have like a recital thing I got to be at. So just for you YouTube folks, see if I put up an announcement that I'm going to go live for the Q&As. If not, then I'll see you Monday. If we have it, I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you guys, and God bless you. Thank you.